Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXLIII, The House That Crassus and Pompey Built. After the death of Crassus, his powerful name, his fortune, and his family's honour survived. In this episode, we'll trace the life of the Crassi yet to come, and how the family comes together with an old rival. Here's Rhiannon Evans. I thought that a good way to wrap up our little mini-series here on Crassus would be to take the family tree forward a bit and explore the lesser-known Crassi. Crassi?
Crassi.
What's a plural?
Crassi, I would say.
Okay. And to see what happens to the family and the fortunes of Crassus, mm-hmm. I guess, because a large amount of inheritance would come along, that there'd be power, there'd be family titles. And initially, we've talked about him having two sons that were involved in the military, that were closely allied with Caesar, but one of those sons dies in battle against the Parthians.
So Crassus's two sons are born to him and his wife Tertullia. We don't know much about her except she'd been married to Crassus's brother previously and widowed. On Tertullia, we get only this slightly scandalous rumor, and it's from Plutarch's Life of Cicero, chapter 25. One of the sons of Crassus, who was thought to resemble a certain Axius, and on this account had brought his mother's name into scandalous connection with that of Axius, once made a successful speech in the Senate, and when Cicero was asked what he thought of him, he answered with the Greek words, Axius Crassu. So it both means Axius of Crassus. So it could be Axius son of Crassus, which doesn't make sense that way around, but also worthy of Crassus. Axius's name means worthy.
Yeah. But he's just making a pointed comment that, you know, the mum sleeps around and this is this son.
Bit of a low point for Cicero, I think.
Yeah, it's low hanging Greek pun. A good way to do this episode just might be to take it a generation at a time, and we'll plod through the family tree, because ultimately, and spoilers here, I think it's really interesting that we get to a certain point where there's a merging of the houses of Pompey and Crassus. Mm. And both Pompey and Crassus, I imagine, would have hated that. But it shows how close the families were and how small Rome is in some ways.
Mm. Well, there's not that many elite families to marry into.
Exactly. And at some point, you're going to be related to the guy that you absolutely hated during your consulship.
Yeah. But I like the way you call them houses. It's like something from Dune, or you're probably thinking Game of Thrones still.
No, I actually wasn't thinking Game of Thrones. But it is like crime family story. Mm. You know, here we've got the Montagues and Capulets finally coming together.
Exactly.
Yeah. We'll start with the first generation. We've got Marcus Licinius Crassus. I've put the second there because he's named after his father. Mm-hmm. And Crassus's other son was called Publius Licinius Crassus. So these two sons we have met previously. They've gone to war alongside Caesar, and we've come across them in the retelling of the life of Crassus.
Mm. Yes. So Marcus the second, who was born in around 86 or 85 BCE. He rises through the ranks as your elite Roman man will. He's quaestor in 54 BCE in Gaul, along with Caesar. When Caesar goes over to Britannia, he's involved in that invasion and is even mentioned by Caesar as being in charge of a legion there. So he's definitely a Caesar loyalist. Mm. He is made the governor of Cisalpine Gaul in 49 BCE, so when Caesar's conquest is finished and on the verge of civil war. He marries Caecilia Metella from a very, very distinguished Roman family. She's the daughter of Metellus Credicus. She is the Caecilia Metella whose massive tomb looks like a fortress tomb on the Appian Way.
Yeah.
They have a son, Marcus Licinius Crassus III. The Romans do not use the numbers, but just to identify them ourselves.
Yes. Okay. A lot of the reading that I did about these two Crassi seemed to be that Publius was the more well-known of the two, the better regarded. We get a mention from Cicero, I think, that Cicero thought much of him, or he looked up to Cicero.
Mm-hmm. So maybe he's not the one who looks like Axius.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Who knows? When you're going to insult Crassus, you take whatever you can get. But in regards to Marcus, who we assume was the elder brother due to the naming convention, but there's no indication that he really was, Ronald Syme seems unimpressed by him, the historian. He later on refers to this Crassus's son as taking more after his uncle as far as being a better soldier and everything. And
Okay, so then we've got Publius, who may have been born in 86 or may have been born in 82. It's not entirely clear. So he's the one who dies at Carrhae. He had also served with Julius Caesar. He might have been just 24 when he went out there, if he's born slightly later. As you've already mentioned, historians regard him a little higher than his brother. He marries Cornelia Metella, so another one of the Metelli. She's kind of known for her intellect, for being a clever and gifted daughter of Metella Scipio. She's kind of the heir of the last surviving branch of the Scipios, this family that had been so dominant throughout the mid-Republic. So he would have been in his late 20s marrying Cornelia, and the marriage may be delayed by his military service. And we know that he dies in Parthia. So Plutarch tells of how he killed himself on the battlefield after being injured in order to allow those who could escape to escape. He didn't want to slow them down, basically. And that he had been pierced by an arrow and he presented his side to his shield bearer and ordered him to strike home with his sword. So I guess it's not suicide formally.
It's suicide in the same way Mark Antony did it.
Requiring an inferior to kill you. So this is kind of presenting his death as honourable for the sake of sparing others. The Parthians, however, mutilate Publius's body and parade his head. They do like to take heads on the tip of a lance in front of the Roman camp.
So they do this to mock Crassus, who survived the battle.
Yeah. And after this, taunts are hurled at his father, at Crassus the elder, for his son's greater courage. Publius Crassus's widow marries Pompey the next year, Pompey's fifth and final wife, and the two families are joined already.
Already, yeah. I guess.
In a way.
Technically, yeah.
They're going to become more joined.
Is that the one who was on the boat watching him beheaded on the shores of Egypt?
Well, she's definitely his final wife.
Yeah. So it depends if I take HBO Rome as being a historical account.
Well, we have discussed that at length, whether we should.
Okay. So those are Crassus's two sons. One dies in battle with him. The other survives, but only for a few more years, but has had a son. So the line continues.
All right. Here we are with Marcus Licinius Crassus III. We're sort of moving through Roman history
This is a great way to kind of explore the tumult of the Roman history.
Yeah. So now we are down to the generation that's alongside the civil war between Mark Antony and Octavian. And initially, a third Crassus fights alongside Mark Antony and Sextus Pompey. So Pompey's son, but eventually he defects to Octavian, the winning side.
Yeah, like so many. It's interesting that yet the next generation, you've got all the same names involved in different sides of the civil war, history repeating itself.
Indeed. And even though, you know, this Crassus is never going to be as famous as the Crassus, our triumvir, you know, he is consul in 30 with Octavian. He's considered important enough for that. Although I guess if I were being fair, I'd have to say by this stage, Octavian is probably making people who can't threaten him co-consul.
Yeah, that's it. You would only give very trusted patsies, yes men, that kind of thing.
He is involved in non-civil war military affairs as well. So he fights against the Gauls, probably against the Macedonians, but he is denied a triumph because by this point, Octavian is starting to only give them to members of his own family. Eventually, he does get one, but Octavian doesn't attend. So there's some kind of split going on between him and Octavian there. He doesn't want his generals lording it over him. And then he disappears from the historical record. Is it suspicious? My anti-Octavian stuff coming through here. He seems to be denied a political career at the very least.
Yeah.
Because we don't hear of him turning up as consul or anything or, you know, going out to be governor somewhere again. We think he didn't have any children, but he did adopt Marcus Licinius Crassus Frugi. So, you know, when you're adopted, you get the first three names of your adopted father.
Okay.
From the Calpurni Pisones family, a very, very elite family in Rome. We're told... you do Syme. You be Syme.
I be Syme. I be the Syme of this podcast. And if I can quote Ronald Syme here...
Sir Ronald.
Ronnie. He resembled his uncle Publius in the scope of his military talent and ambition. So that's a sledge against his father in some ways. Can you say a little bit about the adoption or the concept of adoption? Is this sort of thing common?
Very common.
When you don't have, by the looks of it, any heirs yourself?
Even if you do, but yes, especially if you don't.
And you fish around for, I assume, a lesser known frugi in this case and say, would you like to be my heir?
Yeah, I mean, there are various advantages to this, that you now have an heir, that family now has potentially added wealth, you know, which it might not have been able to give. If there are several offspring, you don't have to divide the wealth or have one son go off and make their own fortune. It's how a lot of the Scipios get to be Scipios.
Yeah.
They can get added in. You know, Scipio Aemilianus is from the Aemilianus family and gets adopted into the Scipios. Mm. Yeah, it's common and it's going to continue to be common. The imperial family will practice it because they so rarely seem to have biological heirs.
True, yeah. We do see it a lot in the imperial history where a distant relative will be adopted back into the family tree to be the next emperor. And it even happened, I guess, with Julius Caesar adopting the young Octavian. Again, distant relative. But in this case...
Not that distant, but yeah.
No, yeah.
Great nephew, yeah.
In this case, not a relative at all, just a different family.
Yeah, it doesn't
family.
Have to be. They're all just one little pack of inbred families, aren't they? The Roman oligarchs of the Republic.
All right, so now we've got Marcus Licinius Crassus Frugi the First.
Yeah. Great name.
Yep.
So now we've moved on from the civil wars to Augustus. Octavian's become Augustus and he's established as princeps.
Mm.
And this guy, I'm just going to call him Frugi to distinguish him.
Yep, Frugi one.
Oh, yes, we're going to get more, of course.
Well, there's more Frugi.
He's consul in 14 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
He gets a decent career. Governor of Hispania Tarraconensis around 10 BCE. We get this from an inscription. And he is the proconsular governor of Africa for 98 BCE. That comes from documentary evidence too. He has a son and a daughter. The son, Marcus Licinius Crassus Frugi, exactly the same name as him, so yeah. The second. And his daughter, Licinia, who marries Lucius Calpurnius Piso, the consul of 27.
Right.
So they're still kind of doing this republican in marriage. I mean, at this point, they don't really know that the empire is going to be all-consuming, do they, or the imperial family.
Mm.
So this sort of family relationships are continuing as they were.
Well, I mean, this is early enough in the reign of Augustus where, you know, it could conceivably be a blip.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, dates that we've got here are, I mean, the latest one we've talked about is 98 BC. Augustus is installed by then, but
yes.
27 BC, consul of 27. At that point, it's not really clear. He doesn't get full powers until 23 BC, really.
Yeah. The next Frugi that we've got, Marcus Licinius Crassus Frugi II.
Mm-hmm.
So we are now four generations on from our Crassus. So we do have an inscription that tells us about his career, and we've got a few random mentions of Frugi II in the historical records. So we know that he's the urban praetor. In 27, he's the ordinary consul, and this would be with Lucius Calpurnius Piso, who is his brother-in-law, as his colleague.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got a reference to him being quite a bit older in 44 CE. He's serving as the governor of Mauritania, so he had quite a long illustrious career here. He was also admitted to the Collegium Pontificum. So go him.
The College of Priests.
Yes.
So he gets the Ornamenta Triumphalia. So that's like getting the honour of a triumph without really having a triumph.
Mm.
You get the bits and pieces, but you don't get the parade because he is a legate of the emperor in Mauritania. And then he goes along with Claudius to Britain when he invades in 43 CE.
Mm.
And he gets the Ornamenta Triumphalia, so the honour but not the triumph, for a second time.
Okay.
See, by this period that they're sort of fudging the whole triumph thing.
Yes.
Triumphs for the imperial family, and just you can say you've got one and you've got bits and pieces, the toga or whatever, but not the actual parade.
It sounds like he has a relatively important military and political career then, I guess, as far as one, a Crassus goes at this time, and two, just as Romans generally do. You don't hear a lot about Roman senators unless they're sleeping with the emperor's daughter. Well done him for this.
I mean, part of this is chance as to which bits of Tacitus have survived,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
So you might have mentioned all kinds of senators during that bit of Caligula and Claudius's reign that's missing, or the end of Nero's. But yeah, it's true. The fact that we get to hear about him means that he's having as illustrious a career as you can have in the imperial period.
Mm-hmm.
He marries Scribonia, who is a direct descendant of the daughter of Pompey, Pompeia.
So again, we've got the family butting up here.
Yes. So, and she is... He marries Scribonia, who is connected with Pompey's family, in fact, of direct descent from Pompey's daughter, Pompeia. So this Scribonia is the great-great-granddaughter of Pompey.
Well, we're about the same number of generations down the line of Crassus as well.
Four on from Crassus and Pompey then.
And the families come together.
Yes.
Okay.
Of course, we're so far on now that I guess that rivalry has become insignificant.
The rivalry is long gone, and what you've got here are just two very illustrious names.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like a power couple. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the wedding that everyone hoped they'd get invited to.
Mm.
I can see this being a good match and a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
My good old buddy Ronnie Syme, though, calls it a match illustrious and fatal, which is very kind of telling. I guess when you've got these people who are powerful in ancient Rome at this point, they are seen as also a threat.
Mm.
You know, at what point does this person with that kind of name and pedigree become somebody who can rival?
Scribonia's father had been executed for treason against Tiberius, so her relationship to Pompey has come through the maternal line. But all of these families are potentially dangerous to the emperor.
Yeah.
So part and parcel of being part of the Roman aristocracy at this point.
Yes.
He doesn't get off The second Frugi, there are some insults that remain against him. Seneca calls him a silly fellow, silly enough to qualify for the purple. This is Seneca the Younger in the Apocalypticosis, which is a satirical work.
Mm.
So it's a work about the deification of Claudius. He's very clumsy, and it's a nasty piece of work.
Pumpkins?
In some ways. Yeah, the pumpkinification,
right,
of Claudius rather than deification. So it's both a jibe at him, but also a jibe at what it takes to be emperor.
And just how much mockery the whole title has.
Yeah. It goes badly. He is executed in 47 CE on a charge of conspiracy, along with his wife and their son, Pompey.
Yes, we will get to the son. Frugi II and his wife, Pompeia, have five children.
Mm.
So this is the most children that we've seen in a Crassus line so far that kind of get to this point.
Mm.
And what I really like here is it's not clear if he takes on the name or if he is given it, but the eldest son is named
Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus.
Mm. So he takes on the name of that illustrious ancestor. The second son is named
Marcus Licinius Crassus Frugi, which is what you'd expect him to be named, because that's his dad's name.
Yes, but this is a second son.
Yes.
So
interesting that they've decided to privilege Pompey's name for the first son.
Crassus would have hated this.
Crassus would have hated it. Maybe it's part of the fatalness that means that his head is raised literally above the parapet there.
Mm.
Calling him that points him out to people.
Yeah.
So there are three other children, one of whom is a daughter. And because women get simpler names, they just get the feminine form of their father's name usually. She's Licinia. But she is notably Licinia Magna.
Mm.
So she gets the Magnus bit thrust on her too.
So a two in the one name.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. And we know the fate of some of these families. So Pompey too?
Yeah, not Magnus for long.
No. Caligula removes the Magnus, which, you know, maybe, yeah, you didn't earn that name.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's part of his family. But yes, Suetonius tells us that. He took from all the noblest of the city the ancient devices of their families. Suetonius doesn't approve.
Mm.
It was restored by Claudius. Claudius didn't approve either.
Always the administration undoing the rulings of the former administration.
Claudius might have had a reason for it because in 43 CE, Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus II married Claudius's daughter, Claudia Antonia. Part of the family give the Magnus back.
Mm.
This Pompeius also goes to Britain with Claudius and is indeed the one who comes back to Rome to deliver the news of the victory of Claudius over the Britons. These things always go wrong, don't they?
Mm.
He dies in 47 CE. Suetonius says that he's executed by Claudius at the instigation of Messalina. Bad wife, Messalina.
Yes.
Bad empress.
Yes.
Pompey was stabbed in the embraces of a favourite youth, according to Suetonius, Life of Claudius.
Got to have all the 39. Scandal you can have in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is what my students decide every week about Suetonius as we go through the emperor's lives. It's all just a scandal mongering.
So around the same time, we've got Frigi II. So this is Pompeius's father and his mother as well, being executed on the same time of charges of conspiracy. So they all got rolled up in the same kind of conspiracy. Meanwhile, the other siblings, Marcus Licinius Crassus Frigi III, seems to have a reasonably lengthy career.
Yeah, until it ends.
Yeah, well, that's always the way. Consul in 64 CE under Nero.
So, year of the fire.
Mm.
Quite the year to be consul.
Yeah.
But does make it into the reign of Nero, so escapes the kind of wipeout by Claudius.
Yes, yes.
Some members of his family. However, he's executed sometime around or after 66 CE, after being implicated in a conspiracy charges brought by Marcus Aquilius Regulus. Pliny the Younger writes about this in a letter. And Pliny's kind of talking about the De Laetores, the people who inform, writing about how terrible and scary life was under Nero. His wife, who's called Sulpicia Praetextata.
Great name.
It is, which means, you know, the praetexter is the broad band on on the toga.
No,
so
I didn't know
it means, it's like saying your surname is I am an elite. So Sulpicia and her children attended the Roman Senate during the early reign of Vespasian, emperor from 69 CE, seeking vengeance. So they want to avenge Frugi's death, Frugi III. Regulus and his associated political circle were prosecuted by the Senate.
So, almost a side note, Frugi III and good old Sulpicia have four children. We will not follow them down through their associated family tree other than, say, which I found a bit interesting, the eldest daughter, Licinia Praetextata.
Keeping that noble name in there.
Served as a chief vestal virgin.
Mm-hmm.
One of the sons, Lucius Scribonius Libo Rupilius Frugi Bonus.
Bonus?
Does that mean we had an extra son and didn't expect it? Served as Suffolk consul in 88 and was an ancestor of Marcus Aurelius.
These elite families are still just keeping it all within the same little gang, aren't they?
Well, sooner or later, everyone is going to be related.
To Crassus.
Mm. Oh, well, yeah, sure. Crassus would have liked that. Yeah. Crassus likes that. So we've talked about Pompey II. We've talked about Frugi III. There's a couple of other siblings that they have. One of them is Piso.
Mm-hmm.
And we've heard about Piso being adopted by Galba. Galba, who's the emperor short-lived after the reign of Nero.
So when you say we've heard, do you mean like way back in our podcast?
Probably way back when. You go back to the Nero episode, we possibly mentioned a Piso being adopted.
Yeah.
That is this Piso, probably adopted because of the connection to Crassus and Pompey.
Yeah, that nobility gives him authority to be emperor. Or, well, that's the hope. It doesn't actually turn out that way. In fact, as your man Syme says, go on, you say the words.
I am the Syme of the podcast. In a vain attempt to redress the iniquity of history and bring back the monarchy to the line of Pompeius and Crassus, but he is killed 4 days after Galba. Tacitus Histories 1:43-7. Rushing, dagger in hand, meet the armed men, and upbraiding them with their crime, he drew the attention of the murderers on himself by his exclamations and gestures, and thus gave Piso, wounded as he was, an opportunity to escape. Piso made his way to the Temple of Vesta, where he was admitted, by the compassion of one of the public slaves. Potentially his niece was there, because his niece became chief festal virgin later on, who concealed him in his chamber. There, not indeed through the sanctity of the place of worship, but through the obscurity of his hiding place, he obtained a respite from instant destruction, till there came, by Otho's direction, and especially eager to slay him, Sulpicius Florus, of the British auxiliary infantry, to whom Galba had lately given the citizenship, and Statius Marcus, one of the bodyguard. Piso was dragged out by these men and slaughtered in the entrance of the temple.
Sacrilegious.
Yeah, pulled out of the temple of the Vesta.
Yeah, and that's chapter 43 of Tacitus Histories 1, and chapter 44 starts, I mean, this is kind of more about Otho, but it's hard not to quote it. No other murder, according to report, gave Otho greater joy. Nasty, nasty. I have to carry on. On no other head did he gaze with such insatiable eyes. What a nasty man Otho is.
Yeah, that's not a good way. And then we've mentioned the last sibling there, Licinia Magna, later killed on the order of Vespasian.
None of them seem to end very well, Matt. This is a depressing lot of people you've brought together for us.
Oh, it's not me. Blame Pompey and Crassus, you know. Blame Tacitus and Ronald Syme.
No, this is really interesting to see where all of this ended up, where their descendants got to.
So it's interesting just how much these two families became intertwined. And I guess that, you know, by this point, the original Crassus's money would have run out, but there would have been more funds because, hey, interest, high yield, that sort of thing.
Well, it's all speculation as far as I know as to what goes on with Crassus's money. Some of this would have ended up with the emperor, possibly.
I'm sure at some point, yeah. And we do have the tombs of a few of these people. So they owned land of what is now the Villa Bonaparte.
Yeah. So you discovered this through this really interesting article about rediscovering the Licinian tomb, it's called, by Catherine Bentz from 1997. When I read the beginning of this and she says it's in the grounds of the Villa Bonaparte, I'm like, oh, Napoleon is always in everything in Europe. There's always some point at which Napoleon will tread on it, even when you think you're doing ancient history. But yes, near the Porta Salaria, not that far from the tomb of Caecilia Metella. So we're in that neck of the woods. And it's kind of fascinating that these sarcophagi have been found in the same location that they were buried there together.
Yeah, so a tomb was found on these grounds. We call it the Licinian tomb now. And it was discovered in the late 1800s during the period of where excavations were more grave robbing. So it wasn't well documented and we don't know exactly what was found there. But it seems like the altar or sarcophagus of Frugi II, his wife Scribonia, and Pompey II, younger Pompey, were all found in here. And also the daughter Licinia Magna, her altar was found on the same grounds. And so you've got an extended amount of family in this one tomb, which is usually what happened. And you've also got, if you look up statues, portraits of Pompey and of Crassus, the busts have all come from this tomb. So what we know of how Crassus looked, about how Pompey looked, comes from the tomb of their descendants, which I think was a great joining of two Roman powers that they both would have hated.
But Crassus kind of gets to win just by virtue of the fact that it's the male members of his family that have provided this link. So it gets to be the Licinian tomb.
By Roman standards, Crassus wins.
Yeah.
That was Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any readily available podcatching platform. Please leave a review and tell your friends about it. You can like the Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Blue Sky. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. Emperors of Rome has been recorded and produced at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.